There are three types of prayer. One I would call absolute prayer. And the Bible reference is in Matthew. And it is, your Father knoweth what things you have need of before you ask him. And that doesn't require us to ask a question. Jesus lived and practiced absolute prayer. Almost every one of his prayers were absolute. There's one that we can think of that's relative, what I would call relative prayer. And that was when he was saying, you know, if praying to have this cup passed from him, if it was possible. The second type of prayer is what I call relative prayer. And that comes from Matthew 7. And that is, ask and it shall be given you. Seek and you shall find. Knock and it shall be opened. The Ten Commandments are both absolute prayers and relative prayers. The Lord's Prayer, the Beatitudes, the Scientific Statement of Being are all relative prayers because it's from our vantage point trying to reach where God is. The third type of prayer is mentioned in James, and it is, ye ask and receive not, because ye ask amiss, that ye may consume it on your lusts. So I would call that praying wrong, right? It's incorrect prayer, prayer that doesn't work. Okay. So I would like to first create, kind of set the groundwork for you. So I want you to ponder this, okay? I want you to picture a city above the clouds that is filled with goodness. There is no evil there. There is no crime. There is no hate. There is no judgment. There is no sun or moon. All of the light that is there is generated by divine light, by a divine source. It is run according to rules. And according to Revelation, there's only one set of rules. And they are Ten Commandments. Here's the proof. In Revelation 11, it says, the temple of God was opened in heaven, and there was seen in his temple the Ark of the Testament. So this glorious city is run by the Ten Commandments. And that is in the absolute sense of the Ten Commandments, and we'll get to that in a little while. There's one other caveat to this kingdom, and that is you can't own anything. You cannot possess anything. You can't have a personal body. You can't have a special friend. You can't possess anything that's material, anything that can be consumed, because nothing is consumed there. Now, how many of us agree to do that? Well, if I asked you to raise your hand, can you do that? The trouble is, I said your. And if you think you have your hand, then you are demanding that you are possessing something. Remember, Jesus said, I came down from heaven, I'm in heaven, and I return to heaven. Okay. Jesus came to show us how to reunite with this kingdom. Now imagine, because you demand possession, what is it that you want? So you might say, well, I want to live in. And you can tell me, you want to live in a mansion, you want to live in a camp, you want to live wherever it is. So you build that around you. So pretty soon you've got this house, then you furnish it. And then you've got big grand windows and you put the drapes up. And one thing that's important is that you find yourself, you are in the center of this beautiful city that's emitting light everywhere. No matter where you go, you're always in the center of the city. Okay. But now you have built a palace around yourself, and that's like it's blocking out the light. It's blocking out that which is holy and pure, because now you're living by your own possessions are controlling you. That's what we call mortal mind or matter or the belief in the power of good and evil. And we want to consume things. A lot of people think that they never hear God, or that they pray and they don't get answers. And I want to share with you the nature of the human mind. The human mind has two different avenues for connecting or receiving information. One avenue is the belief of good and evil. So it is about everything that comes from the five physical senses, everything that is that arrives to us from the physical senses and is recorded on what we think of as a brain. Okay. But there's something else. And it's called hope, faith. It's called conscience. It's called intuition. Now, intuition and conscience are not derived from the brain. They are not received to the brain. They are completely separate. And I want to share with you a wonderful experiment that kind of verifies it in an interesting way. There was some scientists that were doing studies on the functions of the brain, and they wanted to find out where creativity comes from, what part of the brain produces the creative impulse. And so eventually, they wired themselves up and they tried to think of something creative, and it took them many hours and they couldn't get there. Eventually, this guy got an insight. He had some moment of the creative instinct. And then they went back and they looked at all the brain, because he had his head all wired up. They looked at all the brain functions. And at the moment of the creative presence, the brain was silent. There was not a single thing going on in the brain. And they decided that there must be something wrong with the equipment. And I started smiling, because the nature of God has nothing to do with the creative, with the brain functions. The difference between you making decisions and possessing something and intuition and hope and faith is that all the functions of the brain that are coming to us from the physical senses have the possibility of good and evil. You can bless, you can curse. You can make decisions, you can make choices. God never makes a decision and never makes a choice. There's only one option, because God is a one power universe. And so when you receive an impulse, you can call it conscience. It's always right. There's no if, and you can decide not to listen. That's a different thing. That's the human mind calculating. But the divine presence that is with you and with everyone all the time is this conscience and intuition that is directing us and teaching us and caring for us. So, and it's available for animals. Have conscience, they have intuition as well, but they don't have a way to raise themselves above it or to become conscious of the difference. And we do. So, you know, if you see a baby crying and you know it's hungry, you just have to feed it. If you see somebody, If I told you to go into a store and steal something, you would say, no, that's wrong. The brain doesn't know that it's wrong, but conscience does. So that is Christ. Conscience is the Christ presence that's talking to us all the time. Now, how much time do we spend magnifying what's coming to us as conscience and intuition and hope and faith? If we practice listening, it grows. It starts out as that still small voice, and it gets louder and louder and louder. And all the inputs that are coming from the physical senses are muted, because we're conscious of a one power universe, which is all good. A lot of people wonder how do we get here, right? And how do we make the mistakes, and how does this possession thing happen? So I want to create a little story for you that illustrates this as an example. Let's assume that you have given up everything and you're living in a completely dark space, and you're all alone. You call out, you hear nothing. You walk around, you can't see anything. There's nothing, there's no input from the physical senses that has any value to you at all. And so you give up. We're going to get to this in the Beatitudes in a minute. And when you give up yourself, you're getting humble. And you hope that somewhere, in some way, there's an answer. There's got to be something, because you know you don't know. Let's pretend, this is just an illusion, this is just a metaphor. Let's pretend that your body starts to glow. Now you can see around you. Let's say you see a warm blanket, you see some food, and you take the food and you take the blanket, you wrap it around you, and you say, I am so grateful for the food and I'm so grateful for the blanket, and your light goes out. Why? Because you forgot your first love. But you remember that when you got humble, it was light. So you get humble again. Now we're in a state called belief, because hope gave you the first light. Belief gives you the second one. So now you're a believer. Like when I got humble, I saw the light. So now let's assume that you're a believer, and you get humble again, and you're just waiting, and you get a little brighter. The light, you just start to glow a little bit more. And pretty soon you see home, family, friends, employment, life is good. And you get up and you thank God and you give a testimony and you say, I'm so grateful for the house. I'm so grateful for my friends. I'm so grateful for the company, for my pets, whatever it is. And your light goes out. Why? Because God didn't give you a house. He didn't give you a family. He didn't give you a home. He didn't give you a job. He didn't give you a blanket. He didn't give you food. He gave you light, and you translated it into a form that was possessive, and it was the possession of something that violates the law of God that made your light go out. And that's how we get to the place of incorrect prayer. When you are praying for things, it doesn't work. When you are seeking the light, you grow from the light to reflection. And from reflection to spiritual forms of beauty and goodness. Okay. Now, when you get there, when you start seeing how that works, you might be willing to pull the drapes apart in this mansion that you've built and see the light that's always there. You see, we've never really left heaven. We've built a shell around ourselves. It's called a veil in the Bible, right? Moses, when Moses came down from the mount, his face was glowing. There's a good metaphor. You've heard that a few minutes ago. Okay. And they made him put a veil over his face. Later, when all the priests wanted to be holy, they put a veil over their face so nobody would know that they weren't inspired. Well, we need to take the veil away and see the beauty. Okay. I want to share with you a story that I think is really helpful. There are many healings in the Bible that Jesus performed. Many of them are not complete enough for us to see whether it was absolute prayer or relative prayer or incorrect prayer. But there's one story that has all those people, all the different believers and the non-believers in them, and it's the blind Bartimaeus along the roadside. And for those of you who don't know the story, I'm going to read it, but I would like you to be listening carefully to who is in relative prayer, who wants to know God, who is living absolute prayer, and who is doubting that it has any power. It says, and they came to Jericho, and as he went out of Jericho with his disciples and a great number of people, blind Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, sat by the highway side begging. And when he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and say, Jesus, thou son of David, have mercy on me. And they charged him that he should hold his peace. But he cried the more, a great deal, thou son of David, have mercy on me. And Jesus stood still and commanded him to be called. And they called the blind man, saying unto him, Be of good cheer, rise, he calleth thee. And he, casting away his garment, rose and came to Jesus. And Jesus answered and said unto him, What wilt thou that I should do unto you? The blind man said, Lord, that I might receive my sight. And Jesus said unto him, Go thy way, thy faith hath made thee whole. And immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus in the way. Did you catch the three categories? Bartimaeus must have known or heard something about the Christ, or he wouldn't have called out. He must have already been a believer, but he was blind to Christ. He wanted to know more. He was hungry. How willing are we, when we have that Christ presence, which is always with us, to cry out? How willing are we to be determined against, oh, that's not going to work? You hear that little voice in your head, you know, praying is not going to help you. But Bartimaeus wanted to know Christ. So he was living in that relative state, and he wasn't asking to be, if you think about it as being blind, he was blind to Christ, and he wanted to know Christ. So he was calling out to Christ. He wasn't trying to get some physical benefit. That was his goal, was to call out to Christ. Now, let's take we know that those who were complaining were the ones who are not, they don't know how to pray. They were the ones who are the incorrect. But now let's look at this whole story from Jesus' perspective. Jesus is living in the absolute presence, right? And so he calls him. What does Bartimaeus do? Bartimaeus had a cape that had identified him as a blind man. As soon as he heard that Christ was going to open his way, he threw it away. What kind of expectation is that? He was already ready. He knew he was going to have an answer. So that's searching and striving for the truth. And he goes to Jesus. I'm just going to paraphrase it. Jesus doesn't see him as a blind man. Jesus can only behold the man that God created. He only sees perfection. So Jesus says, What can I do for you? And Bartimaeus says, Well, I'm blind to you. Jesus says, No, you're not. You see, the Christ presence is very addictive, in that Jesus' consciousness of Christ radiated out from him like a light beam. It was the truth was radiating out of him. And so instead of Bartimaeus having the veil on, he caught Jesus' thought. And it's like Bartimaeus saying, Well, I thought I was blind, but I guess I'm not. That's absolute prayer. It's not asking to be healed. It's recognizing that there's nothing to heal. So Bartimaeus received a scientific healing. He recognized that there was nothing to heal. And what did he do? He immediately followed Jesus in the way. He didn't say, Thanks, buddy, and go back to, picking apples. He followed him. He became a disciple immediately, because now he understood something about Christ and he felt it. Okay, so let's review the Beatitudes. The first four Beatitudes are mental attitudes. It's where we should be mentally. The second four are practice, what you do with it. It's about practicing being a Christian. Okay. So this is these are all like relative prayers. I think you would call it that. In the King James Version of the Bible, the word blessed, if you look up the meaning, it says happy. Now, the original text in the Beatitudes was forceful and moving. So a more accurate interpretation of the word blessed would be walk forth with joy. So really, if we said walk forth with joy, those who are poor in spirit, for theirs are the kingdom of heaven. That's a more accurate way of listening. So it's not just being settled. It's like Bartimaeus, like being immediately following Jesus in the way. So he's walking. Bartimaeus was walking forth with joy. He was obeying the Beatitudes. Now, let's just review them briefly. To be poor in spirit is an example of what I just explained to you when you're in the total darkness. Poor in spirit means you know you don't know. You've been kicking around in this world, repeating the same problem over and over. You can't solve it. And eventually you give up because you don't know the answer. To be poor in spirit is a state of utter humility. You have given up any struggle with your brain to try to figure it out. The answer is not there. And humility is the first condition that's required for any answered prayer. These, you can't pick and choose which beatitude you like. Okay. They add like colors to a rainbow. They add one to another. Each one is required from the previous one. The second beatitude is walk forth with joy. Those that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Now you might think of that as, you know, someone who's feeling woeful, or they're crying, or, you know, sad, and that they're going to be comforted. And that's kind of a superficial meaning of it. But let me take it a little bit further. When you know you don't know, and you receive an answer, that's wonderful. But that doesn't mean that you've stopped possessing things. Okay. To mourn is to, when you recognize that you have got to give up everything. Christ, go and sell all that you have. And you say, well, I'll let you have this. I'll give up my addiction to chocolate, but I really want to have my Porsche. You know, it's like, you can't do that. So we mourn our losses when we recognize that in order to live, in order to remove this barrier and live in the city of our God, we have to give it all up. And we don't do that willingly. There's part of us that is willing and part of us that's not willing. And we can talk about that a little bit later. The third beatitude is blessed are the meek. So once you have attained the first two, you find it unnecessary and impossible to judge one another. You can't judge because you know everyone has to get to this place of utter humility and of giving it all up. And the fourth one is walk forth with joy, those that hunger and thirst after righteousness. That's a powerful place. It means that you have no other thought. If you were under the water, you might have no other thought than I have to breathe. Therefore, I have to lift my head above it. That's what it means to hunger and thirst after righteousness. You have no side additions. It's like I'm going to pray for 5 minutes or do my lesson, and then I'm going to go and do something else. Hungering and thirsting after righteousness is never leaving the position of all I have is conscience and intuition and hope and faith. Okay, those are the first four. If you have those attitudes, all of them, then you can proceed to be helpful to humanity. Okay. So the first one is to be merciful. Does anyone not know what that means? to love mercy. The sixth one thing that you might notice in your study of scripture is that when the number six shows up, it's always a key to the final answer. And it's always love. Love is always the highest and hardest for the human mind to comprehend because we love lust more than we love divine love. But it is blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. So number six beatitude is a key. It also shows up in Revelation about five times in that position. And number seventh is to be a peacemaker. Well, be a peacemaker is what Jesus came for. You don't subdue your enemies. You love the hell out of them, right? So there are no enemies. So that's what it means to be a peacemaker. The last one is the one that everyone doesn't want. They kind of really hesitate, and it's blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. It says, rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven. How many are willing to rejoice and be exceeding glad when they're being persecuted for righteousness' sake? Well, I want to tell you, being persecuted for righteousness' sake is like getting your diploma. If you have succeeded in the first seven beatitudes, you are worthy of being persecuted because the world is going to hate you for leaving all for Christ. You have left the physical senses. You have left those influences. You've left lust and hypocrisy behind. And the world's going to say, you can't do that. No, we're not going to let you. So we're capable of that. Let me maybe a little example about how we can hate God or feel like we need that we're persecuting. Let's say that you've spent your whole life gaining something by cheating, and all of a sudden somebody shows up that can reveal the fact that you were breaking the law. What would you do? Would you be humble enough to say, I submit, and here's all the gain, all my ill-gotten gain? Or would you say, you know, it's easier just to kill the witness, right? Okay, now let's take the second stage. Let's say that you have been doing everything right according to the normal human behavior. You're a good person. You follow the rules. You've earned a great reputation. You've become successful. And all of a sudden you realize, like Solomon did, it's all vanity and vexation of spirit, and there's no profit under the sun. Are you willing immediately to give up all your possessions? Or would you really rather continue owning them and avoid the insight that you got? Because you have to find another way. That's actually persecuting, right? It's hating God. So that's how persecution shows up. It's an example. I would like to just share with you an outline of it. It shows up in the book of Revelation, but the first part of Revelation from chapter 2 to chapter 12 is involved in wanting to have the right answers and being willing to move like Bartimaeus was from his blindness to Christ. You could also talk about, Saul being blind to Christ, and all of a sudden he woke up. Same, it's very similar to Bartimaeus. And chapter 13 through 18 is a discussion of, I don't want to give up my possessions and all the stuff, the turmoil that you go through. So I think this might be helpful because this is an outline, very briefly, of all the chapters from chapter 2 to chapter 12. The mental states that you will go through in order to see resurrection consciousness or be able to witness the ascension. I'll share it for you. And it's only a couple sentences. One, if we have remembered our first love, light. Two, held to the first commandment through fiery trials. Three, learned to discern between the finite and the infinite. Or stopped trying to have religion in our head, which is hypocrisy. Five, become consecrated. Six, learned that love is the key. Seven, overcome lethargy toward knowing God. That's the messages to the churches. Deciphered the symbols that identify God. That's Revelation 4. Recognized Christ and accepted his instruction. That's Revelation 5. Then we have given up our egotism, our envy, our false judgment, our pallid lack of faith, our hatred of Christ, and all efforts to deceive ourselves by hiding behind the subterfuge. That's the unsealing of the book. With great love, we are encouraged to push on to our reward. We must learn to be still. Listen. At this point, the repentant part of us is willing to be purified, baptized by fire, and we offer ourselves upon the golden altar. In other words, we're following Jesus' example. On the altar, we lose our attention to our fleshly body. We give up our material origin. We recognize the flaws in all material means and methods. We break our bondage to physical law. The Father's baptism unveils the mystery of evil as we discover that material losses cannot kill us, for God is our life. The Son's baptism demonstrates the truth that overcomes the lie and takes us through the open door where we discover a little book open, that's chapter 10, and a reed like a rod. Those are the little book open is the key to scripture, and the reed like a rod is having it written in your heart. So, 7, we realize that perfection is within our grasp and is inevitable, but we do not want to admit it. Must we really give birth to the grand idea so that the mystery of God should be finished? Yes. That takes us to our preparation for chapter 12, where we see the woman with the crown of 12 stars. But that's the pattern that you will follow if you would agree to practice the Beatitudes. Practice doesn't mean that you have to sit in an office and wait for somebody to call. It means that you practice when you're doing the dishes. You mop the floor with grace. It's agreeing to do it with great humility and meekness and great love. And we're cherishing all the attitudes and the benefits that Jesus has given us. And if you're doing that, you are in the practice of being a Christian. And that's the demand of the hour. It's not enough to say, I'm a Christian. You have to actually prove it for yourself. I'd like to review very briefly the Ten Commandments. I know you all know them, but there's two ways to read it. Jesus said there are two great commandments. One is to love God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul. And the other is to love your neighbor as yourself. The first commandment is the first one that Jesus gave us. But 2 through 10 is to love your neighbor as yourself. So that compiled, to love your neighbor as yourself, means to no graven images, don't take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, and so forth. When Moses gave the 10 commandments to those children of Israel, they thought it was behavioral. And that would make it a relative prayer. Love God first, put God first, but then no graven images to them. Don't make a golden calf. Don't take the Lord thy God in vain. Men, don't swear. Remember the Sabbath day. Come to church on the Sabbath. Honor your father and mother was, you know, don't disobey your parents. Don't kill. Men, don't kill a Jew. Anybody else is okay. Don't commit adultery. Don't mess with your neighbor's wife. Don't steal. You know what that means. Don't bear false witness. Don't lie for personal benefit. Don't covet. Don't have any envy. Now, I would like to translate it and rewrite it for this age at this time when it is known to be an absolute prayer. There's only one commandment, the first, and all the other commandments are like a rainbow, taking the first commandment and dividing it up into pieces so that you know the full radiance of the first commandment. Okay, so let's look at it from that vantage point. Thou shalt have, if all these prayers are about God, we have to get out of ourselves and look at it from God's vantage point. Thou shalt have no graven images. That means, well, for example, if I look out the window and I see a tree, I have just graven an image on my brain. I know what a tree looks like. So God says, you can't use your brain to think of me. No thought other than me. You can't engrave anything other than the divine mind. Do not take the Lord thy God in vain is I am omnipotent. This is a one power universe. I live you. I think you into existence. I love you into existence. You have no mind of your own. I am thinking you. Think about the vantage point and the advantages of that. Remember the Sabbath day, combine that with praying without ceasing. Jesus didn't give 10%. He gave 100%. Don't ever leave church. Church is the structure of truth in the form of love. Live that. Honor your father and mother is to identify God as father and mother, not human parents. Thou shalt not kill. God says, you can't kill me. You cannot adulterate me. You cannot steal. You cannot possess anything. I own you. Doesn't that change things? Any effort that we have to try to possess, to try to steal, to try to benefit ourselves is a direct insult. And it's what takes us away from that holy city. Thou shalt not bear false witness. You can't lie to me. I know everything. I know everything that's good. And you can't covet. You can't envy. You can't have personal friends. The light that shines from the sun does not decide. I want to land on that beautiful flower. I don't want to land on the dust heap. The light just shines. And by the way, there's no dust heap in heaven, but it's an infinite embrace, infinitely acknowledged. So the Ten Commandments from that vantage point is an absolute prayer. And it is the absolute prayer that rules in the kingdom of heaven. And what we have to do is open the door, open the drapes, and walk out. And anyone who knows Christian Science and reads the allegory in miscellaneous writings knows that the imagery that I just gave you was not mine. It's not original. The palace that we built, the palace or the kingdom of heaven, that glorious city is consciousness. Either your consciousness is pure and holy, which you have immediate access to right now as conscience and intuition. And we think it's kind of a low side thing, but it's really the only thing that will remain. You will forget everything except what God is giving you. I got through the foundation, taking me a little longer than I thought. But what I would like to share with you now is the questions that I received. And if you want to stop me, anybody here, just raise your hand and we can stop and ask a different question. But I will I tell you what the questions that were that arrived, and I can address some of those. The first question that came was, how did the prophets pray? How can you? And another question that is very similar is, how can I find out my purpose in life? Well, to know how the prophets pray is to recognize that you are one. Okay, so do you remember Job when Job is us? He went through. He thought God never left his view. God always looked at Job and said, "Look at Job; he's perfect." But Job had to go through hell. He lost his family. He lost all of his possessions. Then he lost his body. And then he had to suffer until he didn't have anything left, right? He was willing to be in that place where, I don't know, he had reached the place of the first beatitude. And he says, I want to know what God thinks. I'm paraphrasing. That's what it says. And God says, okay, where wast thou when I laid the foundation of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. Now, Job answered it. He said, you know. And I took this on when I was reading the story of Job and loving it. I said, you know, if God asked Job, where were you? Then God asks each one of us, that's a God question. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Now, you can't answer a God question because remember, God is mind. And you don't have one. God is thinking you. So if God asks a question, God has to answer the question. So I accepted that as a question for myself. And I sat in silence for 3 days. And after 3 days, I heard a voice, very distinct, very clear. And it said, I was with you, wasn't I? What a comforting, beautiful thing to know. It wasn't my voice. It was answered in a way as if it came through me, but it was presented to me as confirmation of my eternal life. There's another passage that I want to share with you, and it is in Amos. And one day I was reading Amos, and it says, surely the Lord will do nothing, but he revealeth his secret unto his prophets. And so I started thinking about all the prophets in the Bible and how holy they were and how humble they were and how powerful they were and how the prophecies were fulfilled. And I was enjoying that for a day or two. And all of a sudden it hit me right between the eyes. Like, wait a minute. He said, I will do nothing. The Lord said, I will do nothing unless I reveal it to the prophets. And I said, oh, if I wasn't prophesied, I don't exist. Because if everything requires a prophecy in order to be fulfilled, then I want to know, where was I prophesied? So I ask you, have you ever asked where you are prophesied? If you hear the answer, you will know your purpose in life. You will know who you are. You will know how you're supposed to proceed with whatever it is that shows you the way. It is the way out for you. I did this, and I did receive an answer. And I'll tell you, these answers are so, they're just so wonderfully fulfilling. So I'm encouraging you to do that. How important is it for you to advance civilization? One of the things that the prophets did, they were singular people, but every prophet moved civilization along. It went from animalistic characteristics or qualities to spiritual definition. Each one of us has a mission to move civilization forward. And I want to present one issue, one interesting conversation. Mrs. Eddy had a conversation with people in her household, and they were talking about prophecy. And one of the people in her household asked a question: will there be another prophet? Will there be another that will take over like Jesus or Abraham or Moses, who will lead us? And Mrs. Eddy's answer was profound. She told that person, go to your room, and I want you to pray. And if you think it's not you, then animal magnetism is handling you. And that goes right back to Amos. Every one of us has a purpose, has a mission, has been prophesied, and must fulfill it. If you think it's not you, then you're being hypnotized into believing something other than your way out of this palace that you built for yourself. Does that answer that question pretty well? The second question is how to pray about relationships. And that's a tough one, because we like to have friends, but we have to understand what true relationship is in order to grow. And I will share with you my own experience, and maybe that's helpful. I was in a place where I was lonely, and I was on a mountain trail, and the nature around me was beautiful, but I wanted a companion. And so my prayer was materialistic. Give me a companion. And then I realized that that was an incorrect prayer. So I tried to find a way to formulate a prayer that would would get me out of the way. In other words, to say I want a companion, it has an opinion, and it says basically the Lord's Prayer only, thy will be done my way. I want a solution and I want it this way. So I thought about it as I was walking along, and eventually the best prayer I could come up with was, dear God, either give me a companion or take away the desire, because I don't like the way I'm thinking, because I knew that it felt disturbing. And so I thought, well, that's a good prayer, because I've gotten my opinion and my choices out of the way. So I let it go. And about a week later, I was sitting in my house and I felt this presence. I knew that what that presence is it's a feeling of being embraced in love. And I heard a voice and it said, okay, I will take away the desire. And I felt myself being submerged. It was like being bathed or being baptized of the Spirit, if you want to call it that. I felt like I was being submerged in the sea of light and love and embraced and clean. And when I came back up, the desire, this lustful or whatever it was, desire for companioning that way was gone. And then about an hour later, the voice came back and it said, now be a companion. And it baffled me. It's like, what do you mean, be a companion? I couldn't figure it out. So my brain is going 90 miles an hour trying to figure it out. And I said, well, it must mean I'm supposed to companion with birds and flowers and people and be happy in the grocery store, or whatever. And I did that for a year. And eventually the practice faded away, until Christ and God are very patient with us, because God never sees you as anything other than perfect. So however long it takes, right? Eventually it dawned on me, oh, what the beautiful thing was, the beautiful request was, companion with me, be my companion, Christ's companion. In other words, it took me a year to get from the lack of taking away my blindness like Bartimaeus, the following him in the way. Oh, that's the way. And so when you understand what true companioning is, then the windows, the gates of heaven are open, and all kinds of companioning shows up in all kinds of ways. But I think that solves the problem of relationships. As an aside, I once knew a practitioner. He was a wonderful man, and a couple called him, and they were arguing with each other. They were having all kinds of fights. And he said, I got my suitcase. I'm getting in my car. I'll be there in 20 minutes. And he just drove to their house and he moved in. He says, we're going to have a holy relationship. And he just stayed until that whole marriage relationship was healed. Now, that's unique, but he met the need where it was. It was just like Jesus saying to Bartimaeus, you're not blind. Okay, so he wasn't willing to accept that as an answer. This is another question, and it's actually a dual question. There's two different ones. It says, divine love always has met and always will meet every human need. Do we have proof? And why is the world so troubled if that's true? And the other one is, thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven. Is it coming to pass? So in the Bible, it says, many are called, but few are chosen. The original text, the inspiration was, everyone is called, but few choose to follow. So there are two ways to advance, to recognize your spirituality. One is to pray correctly, to be humble, to follow the Beatitudes. And the other one is furnace fires or your struggle until you get to the point of giving up, and then you start right? So that's what it is. I will share one experience with you. I have a few minutes. And this was an experience that taught me how divine love meets every human need. And it comes to us in interesting ways, and not necessarily, we don't necessarily see the end at the beginning, but if we're willing to follow, to listen that to that still small voice, then the way will open up. This was a situation where I was working as a designer. I owned my own company. I had a big building that was right beside a railroad track. This railroad track, I worked there for years. This railroad track was defunct. It was rusty. There was nothing on it. And across the railroad track on the other side was a post office. It was my practice every day at 20 minutes after 8. I would get up from my work. I would walk across the railroad tracks. I would get my mail and I would come back. So this particular day, I'm working on a project. I see the clock. I get up to get the mail and I hear, "Not now." Are you going to listen? So I said, I thought, okay, not going to get the mail now. And so an hour later, an hour passes, and I remember, oh, I didn't get the mail. I get up to hear again, "Not now." So I stop, go back to work. And then about an hour later after that, I was running some heavy industrial equipment. I had big motors running. I'm in the process of doing something right in the middle, making a big cut. And I hear, "Now, get the mail." It was a shock, but I was obedient. I shut up all the equipment, walked across, got out, went out the door, walked across the old railroad tracks, got the mail, completely uneventful, not just like every other day. I walk out. I got about 20 feet out in front of the post office. And at that moment, I knew why I was there. There was a car coming, and around the corner, couldn't see, about 50 miles an hour. It's a 25 mile an hour zone. There was a train coming. There was nothing there. There's no way anybody would know. And so at that moment, I knew why I was there and what I was supposed to do. I jumped out in front of the car. So the guy slams on his brakes to avoid hitting me. I get out of the way. And by then he sees the train and the car skids toward the train. It stops about a foot. It arrives at the intersection of the train and the car exactly at the same time. And the car stops about a foot in front of the train as the train passes. My first thought was, God must love that man. And I walked up to the car. The guy was in shock. And so I just talked to him. I just stayed with him until, because he couldn't drive. I just stayed with him until he regained his composure. And then he went on his way. Now, there's a lot of things that are significant about that. 2.5 hours earlier, I was already being led. That's intuition. And intuition means you're a prophet, because you feel something is necessary for you in what looks like to us as being the future. To God, God says, "This is now." This has nothing to do with the future. It's all-knowing. So that's an example of divine love meeting a human need. Now, if we don't do that, we suffer. And so that's why there's all kinds of things that are going on in this world that appear to be out of control. But actually, you see, the laws of God don't start and stop, depending on whether you're listening or not. The angel messages are being fed to you all the time. If everyone in this world were actually listening to conscience and intuition, there would be no crime. There would be no death. There would be no war. The laws of God are still in operation. A law ruling a city is written in order to provide order for that city. The law knows nothing about whether you're being obedient or disobedient or, you know, getting in trouble or hurting yourself. The law is there to provide order. So God doesn't know anything about you running around, you know, or just being disobedient or missing the opportunity to bless someone. So divine love is meeting every human need. Who's listening? And you're either learning by suffering or you're learning by grace. Okay, so in our experience, grace shows up sometimes and sometimes we forget. So we need reminders, right? Can I go a little bit further, a little bit longer? I have another question. How do we pray about war? If you are practicing your intuition, if you are practicing loving your neighbor as yourself, all you need to do is expand your practice. Embrace a larger and larger audience with your love. Pour it out. Your prayers are heard around the world. Be willing to recognize not to take the Lord thy God in vain, because there is no distance between my God and me. And so me is the me that is God is everywhere. And I will share with you one little experience that I had, and that is this. This is years ago, but I was having a heated argument with someone, and he knew that he was right, and I knew that I was right. So nobody's going to win this argument. And all of a sudden, I hear a voice, and it says, the two-edged sword of truth. You're only using one edge. So I ask, what is that? What? And the answer comes back. One edge identifies the evil in your practice. The other edge removes the bad activity. So the impulse to sin and the practice, the lust and hypocrisy, is removed. So this was a shock to me. So I stopped what I was ready for my rebuttal. I talked to this guy, was not religious in the least. I said, I just had an epiphany. Would you like to hear it? He goes, yeah. So I just explained to him what I just said. One edge removes the desire, right? And the other edge removes the bad activity. And we both stood there and asked ourselves, what were we arguing about? Neither one of us could remember what the argument was about. The truth sword had removed the error and the bad activity so completely that it was as if it never happened. It removed the memory of having had the argument. Nobody could remember what it was. There's one other which I would love to answer, and it is, how do you pray about lack or money, whether it's too little or too much, or whether you have an obsession with money and so forth? And I would like to answer that with an experience that's not mine, but it was an experience of a Christian Science practitioner who I knew personally very well. And this was an elderly lady. She had been a Christian Science practitioner for 40 years. She was retired. She was of retirement age, and her husband was retired. And she was depending upon the income from her prayers to provide everything for the house. They had a big colonial house, and the house was needing repairs, and it wasn't meeting the need. And so she started thinking about resources, and she realized that she was counting dollars and looking in her checkbook and trying to balance it when there wasn't enough income. And then she realized that if everything is spiritual, then income has to be only coming from God, not from people, not from banks, not from dollar bills, but God is my only source of income. So this is literally what she did. She said, I can't send out any bills anymore. And I can't think about life in, you know, the business the way I have. I'm going to be grateful for everything. So she stopped looking at money. She stopped looking at her bank account. Every day she would go down to her mailbox. If there was a bill, she would immediately take out a check, write the check, say, she just poured out gratitude. Thank you for the electricity. Thank you for the heating. Thank you for the telephone service. Doesn't matter what it was. She immediately wrote a check and put it in the mail. She never looked back. people would call for her, call to her for prayer. She never sent out another bill. If people were grateful and they sent her a check, she never looked at who sent it. She never looked at how much it was. She turned it over, signed her name on the back, put it in an envelope and mailed it to the bank. No deposit slip, because she couldn't look at it. She just mailed it to the bank. She never looked at it again. 2 months passed. She got a call from the president of the bank. And he said, "Mr. Blake, you have to come to the bank." "Why?" He said, "You have way too much money in your checking account." So she went down and she balanced her books the way he had recommended. And she went back home. 2 months passed. She got another call from the president of the bank. "Mrs. Lacey, you have way too much money in your checking account." You see, we don't do things expecting a return from people. All good comes from the divine. Give it credit for everything. God is living you. God is loving you into existence. You have infinite resources. Demonstrate that. That's the answer. Those are the questions that I have. Does anybody have any questions that are here you want to ask? Okay. I'd like to conclude by an experience, and that is this. One day I was in church, and I wasn't listening to the sermon from the vantage point of the readers. I was listening to it from the source that made it, in other words, the divine source. And so I was listening to it from the highest level that I knew. John would say I was in the spirit on the Lord's day. Okay. And what happened was, it was like being in a cloud and you go through the cloud and it clears. The entire church that I was sitting in dissolved. It became transparent. And right in front of me, what I saw was Holy Jerusalem coming down from God out of heaven. I was a witness in the same way that John was a witness to Holy Jerusalem. I can tell you that it's real. I can't tell you anything about how to describe it, because it's not, there's nothing in heaven, nothing in spirit that's three-dimensional. There's nothing that you can measure, but it is there. I heard a voice, a very loud voice, like John would have said, as rushing mighty waters or as a lion roars. It said, "This is now." And the moment that I heard that, I understood what the divine definition of now is. I can't tell you what that is either. But I can tell you that it embraces and encompasses the all of infinity. I could feel the presence of the ancient prophets. They were there. I understood how Jesus could talk to Elias and Moses. It wasn't hard. He just had to ask. Form, the idea of going from light to reflection to spiritual objects. All ideas in heaven have form. They're incredibly beautiful. We are incredibly beautiful, transparent, completely identifiable beings. And gradually, the church came back, and I was sitting in the church. I desperately wanted to go back. I wanted to know what now means. And as soon as I was back in brain consciousness, I couldn't do it. I have little pieces. I can talk a little bit about it like I am now, but I couldn't tell you what its full nature is, because we're going back and forth between the belief of good and evil being this environment and the Christ consciousness, which you have. When you sell all that you have and there's nothing left but Christ consciousness, then you will know. And I've experienced moments of that enough to share with you that it's real. So that spiritual city of our God, which you would call spiritual consciousness, I was in a place like being in the audience. I was not on the stage. I was watching it. I know what it is, but I wasn't experiencing it. To be on the stage and be living it is to ascend. I can encourage you. There's no way you're going to get out of that. You are going. You, however long, how much do you want? How much do we want to suffer in order to get there? We will either learn it by suffering or by science. We have been given the key. We can get there. One way to think about it is this. Moses taught us what to pray. Jesus taught us how to pray. And Mrs. Eddy gave us the key to absolute prayer. Jesus was living absolute prayer, but how to arrive was given to us as a key, which is divine love, embracing all. If you think about truth as being a two-edged sword, it's kind of like you're not sure, you know it's true. But if you take that truth and you wrap it up in divine love, you embrace it, then you can swallow it, right? It's no longer bitter to experience because you're willing to let it go. This workshop was held in my home in Knoxville, Tennessee, on Saturday, November 5th, 2022. Contact information can be found at publishinggood.com or publishinggood.org or by phone at 636-256-6555.